Well, if you look at your calendar, Easter is in 2 weeks, which is an interesting holiday if you actually do some research on it. But during this time of year, more people are thinking about the death and the resurrection of Jesus. And because of that, for the next couple of weeks, what I'd like to do is for us to examine some of the events that led up to that. Now, have you ever had someone stab you in the back, or double-cross you, or sell you out, or abandon you? You see, personally, I've only had a few minor instances, like that kid who said he didn't want to be my friend anymore because some other kids said I wasn't cool, and so he started hanging out with the kids who liked to bully me. But I don't know, for you, maybe it was at work, or at school, or maybe even on social media. See, well, it's one thing for your enemies to do bad things to you, but it's quite another for your closest friends to do them. And I wonder if that added to the agony that Jesus had in his final hours. So if you would, grab a Bible. Let's be turning over to John chapter 18. Now, John spent the last 5 chapters in the upper room. But after they left that upper room, it's kind of like the dominoes just started falling toward the crucifixion. So it was during the time of the Jewish Passover, our April. And after he had washed the disciples' feet and they had the Last Supper, it was ended, and Jesus' talk and prayer with them when they were ended, well, they crossed the Kidron Valley and they went over into the Garden of Gethsemane. You see, in John chapter 18, so we're coming to the climax of Jesus' life, and we're able to examine some of his final hours before his crucifixion. Now, first, at the garden, now that's going to be what we're going to look at today, and then at the residence of the high priest, that'll be next week. And we see Jesus' attitude and actions as he was betrayed by Judas and then questioned by Annas. And we see Peter, we look at Peter's mistakes as he first tried to defend Jesus and then denied that he knew him. Now, I don't know if you've ever been arrested or not, but it's not the most pleasant experience. I've only ever been arrested once so far. They thought that my roommate and I were the guys who had just robbed a liquor store. The cops figured it out, of course, that it wasn't us. But before they did, they handcuffed us and frisked us. And the point is, it's not my most favorite memory. But let's start here with verses 1 through 3 when Jesus was arrested. When Jesus had spoken these words, he went forth with his disciples over the ravine of the Kidron, where there was a garden into which he himself entered and his disciples. Now Judas also, who was betraying him, knew the place, for Jesus had often met there with his disciples. Judas then, having received the Roman cohort and the officers from the chief priests and the Pharisees, came there with lanterns and torches and weapons. Okay, the Kidron, that was east of Jerusalem, between the wall of the city and the Mount of Olives. It divided the city from the mountain. And the word that's translated ravine here, it's literally winter torrent in the original. Some versions say brook. And from what I've read, at the bottom was a creek that was mostly dry except during the rainy seasons. Now, obviously, it's a bit different now since there's been 2,000 years of erosion, excavation, and development. But I'd still love to get over there to check it out. Someday maybe I will. At least I was able to go on this virtual tour on YouTube a couple of days ago. Well, here's another angle. Now, we don't know if he was exaggerating or not, but Josephus, the first century Jewish historian, he told of a Passover when over 250,000 lambs were slain in Jerusalem. That is a lot of blood. So what'd they do with it? Well, from what I understand, there was a channel that drained the blood down to the Kidron. And so when they were crossing the brook, it would be red with the blood of the lambs that represented what he was about to do, what he was about to fulfill. As it says in 1 Corinthians 5:7, Christ, our Passover, was sacrificed for us. Now, of course, it was nighttime and harder to see color, but you know, it's an interesting idea. Putting the Gospels together, we learn from Matthew and Mark that this garden was called Gethsemane, meaning olive press. And you can see here on the map where they think it might have been, although we don't know for sure. That's the traditional spot where they show people today with some really old olive trees in it. Now, being what's believed to be the last of the four Gospels written, you'll notice that John often passed over these things, over quite a few things that were fully described by the other Gospels. I mean, there's no need to repeat it. And we learn from Luke's Gospel that this is where Jesus spent the night during the last week before his crucifixion. And we also learn from the other three Gospels about Jesus' distress and prayers in this garden and the visit from the angel and his disciples falling asleep before he was arrested. And some people like to make a contrast between the Garden of Eden in Genesis and the Garden of Gethsemane. You see, in the Garden of Eden, Adam tried to hide from God, but in this garden, Jesus presented himself to the Father. In the Garden of Eden, it was, "My will be done," but here it was, "Thy will be done," as Jesus prayed. Well, in verse 2, we can see that Judas, one of the apostles, entered the scene. And Matthew 26 tells us that Judas had previously made an agreement, a bargain with the chief priests. Then one of the 12, named Judas Iscariot, went to the chief priests and said, "What are you willing to give me to deliver him up to you?" And they weighed out to him 30 pieces of silver. And from then on, he began looking for a good opportunity to betray him. Now, the interesting thing is, Jesus knew that Judas would expect to find him at this spot, but he didn't avoid it. I mean, he could have easily gone somewhere else and sidestepped this arrest. And I'm reminded of what he said in John 10. "For this reason, the Father loves me, because I lay down my life that I may take it again. No one has taken it away from me, but I lay it down on my own initiative. I have authority to lay it down, and I have authority to take it up again." And we're going to see that more as this progresses. Now, some people like to put it like this. Jesus was not a victim. He was a volunteer. And we see that Judas was guiding this group of people to arrest Jesus. And it's hard to know how many there were. It sounds like it's like a decent-sized group. And John first mentioned the Roman cohort, the Roman military presence in the city. They might have been there at the Passover. They might have been there in Jerusalem at this time for the purpose of maintaining order during the Passover. Now, from what I've read, at the Passover, there were extra soldiers in Jerusalem. And they were stationed at the fortress of Antonia, which is a military barracks that overlooked the temple. Now, a cohort is normally 600 men, but it probably wasn't the whole cohort that came out. I mean, they would be needed at the fortress and other places as well. So this is probably a small detachment. Okay, it's a representative number of them. And the Jewish leaders, they had obviously talked to Pilate or at least the commander of the cohort and convinced them. You know, we see the commander there mentioned in verse 12. And convinced them of the need for Roman soldiers to come along, possibly expecting armed resistance from Jesus and his followers. And then he mentioned officers from the chief priests and the Pharisees. And so this is likely speaking of the temple police made up of the Levites who kept order around the temple. And, well, the chief priests, they were the members of the Sanhedrin. That's the highest ruling court of the Jews led by the high priest. And many of them at this time were Sadducees. Here's the thing. The Pharisees and the Sadducees, well, they disagreed on a lot of things, but they were united when it came to Jesus. And so there were political and religious motives behind this arrest, but we learn from Matthew and Mark that even Pilate recognized that it was mainly because of envy. And Luke in his gospel makes it sound as if there were actually some chief priests and elders who had come along as well to witness this arrest. All right, reading this, you may be thinking, well, that's a bit overkill, isn't it? That many? But they're probably thinking, okay, this is our chance and we can't mess it up. We have got to get this right. Nothing can go wrong. Because they've been unsuccessful so far at arresting Jesus. They want to make sure of it this time. And of course, it doesn't matter how many people you have. If Jesus doesn't want to be arrested, you can't arrest him. Well, it's at night, and so they had lanterns and torches. And we learn from Luke why they did it at night. It's because they were afraid of the common people, as many of them were coming to believe in Jesus. And many of them, they loved him. And as a side note, look around. What do you see? We're a bunch of common people. I don't see very many celebrities or those with power today in our assembly. And so they hired Judas to lead them to Jesus when he was away from the multitudes. And when most of the people were, they were home in bed. They had Roman soldiers, they had temple police, they had their inside man. It was at night, and it was outside of the city. Now, it was a full moon, being the Passover, but of course there were olive trees, maybe there were clouds, and so they brought extra light. They may have expected Jesus to flee, and so they'd have to, need to search for him if he's trying to hide from them. But they'd also need light to make sure of his identity among all the other men he was with. It'd be very easy for someone to try to take his place as a decoy. Yeah, I'm Jesus. But even with the lanterns and torches, it might have been difficult, because you remember, Jesus was just a normal guy. He didn't have a halo as in the paintings. And so we learn from the other Gospels that Judas came up and kissed Jesus to signal which one he was. It is a common greeting in that culture. And it may have been after that kiss that Jesus came forward and presented himself to them. So let's continue here with verses 4 through 9. Jesus, therefore, knowing all the things that were coming upon him, went forth and said to them, "Whom do you seek?" They answered him, "Jesus the Nazarene." He said to them, "I am he." And Judas also, who was betraying him, was standing with them. When therefore he said to them, "I am he," they drew back and fell to the ground. Again, therefore, he asked them, "Whom do you seek?" And they said, "Jesus the Nazarene." Jesus answered, "I told you that I am he. If therefore you seek me, let these go their way, that the word might be fulfilled, which he spoke, 'Of those whom you have given me, I lost not one.'" Okay, if it had been me there and they were after me, I would have been very tempted to say, "I think he went that away." Right? It says that Jesus knew what was coming. Throughout the Gospel of John, we find the phrase, "His hour had not yet come. His hour had not yet come." But now, his hour had come. There was no disappearing or passing through their midst this time. The way to the cross, it was plainly before his eyes, and he had accepted it. He was going to be mocked, spat upon, beaten with fists, scourged, a crown of thorns jammed onto his head, hit with a reed, paraded through the streets carrying his cross, and then nailed to chunks of wood in public to die a very slow and painful death. He didn't want to go. And as we're going to see, he didn't have to go. But he did. He did because of his love for us. Well, after asking whom they were seeking, they parroted their orders, "Jesus the Nazarene." Okay, let's just stop there for a moment. It's very interesting that Jesus didn't identify as Jesus ben Joseph, son of Joseph, his adopted father. He didn't identify as Jesus of Bethlehem, his birthplace. He didn't identify as Jesus the carpenter or the rabbi, Jesus the rabbi. No, he identified as Jesus of Nazareth. And what's interesting about that is Nazareth seems to have been a despised place. As Nathanael asked, "Can anything good come out of Nazareth?" John 1:46. But Jesus didn't mind it. In fact, I wonder if it was on purpose. Later in Acts 24, Tertullus was accusing Paul before Felix and referred to Christians as the sect of the Nazarenes. And guess what? In the Arabic-speaking world, they will still refer to Christians as Nazrani. It's not a compliment. In the end of 1 Corinthians chapter 1, Paul talked about how God likes to use the foolish and the weak and the lowly and the despised things of the world. Well, John then mentioned Judas standing with them. And being an eyewitness, I am sure he remembered seeing the traitor standing there in the torchlight with the Lord's enemies. Judas had clearly chosen which side he was going to be on. So can you imagine what that have felt like, to have a friend do that to you? Maybe you've experienced a similar betrayal. Now, the Gnostic Gospel of Judas, which was written in the 2nd or 3rd century, it consists of these supposed conversations between Jesus and Judas, and I've read it. And among a bunch of other odd things, it has Jesus asking Judas to turn him in, to help him finish his appointed task from God. And yeah, there's some argument that it was poorly translated and that that's a mistake, but a lot of people have bought into this. The problem, other than the fact that it's a Gnostic gospel written much later, is that John 13 lets us know that Judas did it because he had surrendered to Satan. John 13, 2, it says, "And during supper, the devil having already put into the heart of Judas Iscariot, the son of Simon, to betray him." And 13:27 says, "After the morsel, Satan then entered into him." I'm sorry, Judas didn't do it because he was a good guy. There's a reason why we normally don't name our kids Judas. See, we reserve that name for something like an ugly guard dog. Well, verse 6, it's interesting. It says that, "When therefore he said to them, I am he, they drew back and fell to the ground." I could be wrong, but I don't think this was miraculous, or they probably would have all run away, like being laid flat, as in the Lord of the Rings movie. See, I think that they probably expected a fight, and so they were already on edge. And I picture them standing close together, and these words of Jesus caused a few of them to jump back, to quickly draw back, and then a number of them began to knock into and trip over each other. So maybe there was just something about Jesus, something about him and these words that he spoke, or maybe the way that he said it, it just caught them by surprise. Or maybe they're just getting ready for a fight, as if they thought Jesus was saying, "Yeah, that's me, what are you going to do about it?" But whatever it was, it would have been pretty embarrassing. And, well, this has probably happened to all of us at one time or another. It's hard to be cool and to feel in control when you trip and fall down. You just feel like a doofus. And I can see them on the ground saying, "Get off me, Malchus! What's your problem? I told you not to drink that fourth cup of coffee." Something like that. And now, of course, what they did was appropriate. See, falling down before him. That's something we are told everyone will do at the end of time. Now, some people make a big deal of the fact that the "he" is not in the original. It's literally "I am." And they point to the divine title that was announced to Moses at the burning bush. "I am who I am," Exodus 3:14. And what Jesus said in John 8:58, "Truly, truly, I say to you, before Abraham was born, I am." And there may be something to that. But then other people, they lean toward the New American Standard translation of this simply being an admission that he is Jesus of Nazareth. "I am he." Now, whatever it is, it does seem to go along with John's gospel, with all the "I am" statements. Well, after they gained their composure, Jesus asked them again, and after they replied, it says that Jesus answered, "I told you that I am he. If therefore you seek me, let these go their way." And it's possible that he had them repeat their orders twice to show them that they had no right to take his disciples. See, their orders were for him and him alone. If the apostles had been arrested, they might have been killed as well. And so here is another great quality that I think we ought to emulate. No matter what was happening to him, Jesus was always thinking of others. But of course, everything about his life and death was for others. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son. Now, John said that it was so the word might be fulfilled which he spoke. "Of those whom you have given me, I lost not one." And that seems to be a reference to what Jesus said in the last chapter during his prayer in chapter 17, verse 12. Now, according to this, Jesus' protection of them was at least in part a physical protection, that they would not stand trial and die along with him. And yes, they would be martyred later. But they had a job to do before that happened. As Jesus told them in Acts 1:8, "But you shall receive power when the Holy Spirit has come upon you, and you shall be my witnesses both in Jerusalem and in all Judea and Samaria and even to the remotest part of the earth." Now, since John 17:12 sounds like spiritual protection, Some people think that by their arrest, the apostles would have been plunged into a spiritual test that was beyond their ability, that was beyond their strength at that time. And so protecting them physically was actually protecting them spiritually. And that may be, but I have no problem with Jesus' protection of them being physical at this time. Again, they had a very important job to do after he was gone. Now, it's pretty clear from our passage that Jesus is the one who's in charge, right? He's actually the one in control here because you've got all of these people and yet they're following his orders. Well, okay, we come now to verses 10 and 11. This is the last part that we'll look at today. Simon Peter, therefore, having a sword, drew it and struck the high priest's slave, cut off his right ear. And the slave's name was Malchus. Jesus, therefore, said to Peter, "Put the sword into the sheath. The cup which the Father has given me, shall I not drink it?" Peter, he apparently had his concealed carry permit, and so he pulled out his sword. And we can see here why Peter is often called impetuous or impulsive Peter, as at so many other times. This is an act of rashness. He didn't listen. Jesus had submitted to their arrest and said, "Let these go their way." But instead of going, "Well, no, Peter," he decides to fight. How often do we get in trouble when we don't listen to Jesus? Well, back in chapter 13, we read that Peter said to Jesus, "I'll lay down my life for you." And so he's probably trying to make good on that boast that he would die for the Lord. Well, the Greek word used here is speaking of a short sword. And so it might have been something like the Roman gladius or gladius. And I assume Peter wasn't aiming for his ear. He probably wanted to chop off more than an ear. I guess he was an expert fisherman, not an expert swordsman. But I don't know, maybe Malchus just did a quick dodge. Now, John tells us that it was his right ear, and so some people wonder if that shows that Peter was left-handed, although, you know, he may have just done a downstroke or a backhand, maybe even attacked him from behind. That's possible. We're going to have to ask for the instant replay when we get to heaven to find out. But all four Gospels mention this event. Here's the thing. Only John names Peter as the disciple who wielded the sword and Malchus as the one who lost the ear. That's curious. And some people think that Peter and Malchus were alive when the other Gospels were written, and so their names were left out to protect them. You know, possibly they were both dead by the time John wrote his Gospel. But then others suspect, or they speculate, that John mentioned Malchus's name because he became a Christian later, and he would have been known by the church, and he may have even been implying, "Go and find this guy, okay? Ask him about it. Boy, does he have a story to tell you." Well, Jesus said, "Put the sword into the sheath. The cup which the Father has given me, shall I not drink it?" Now, the cup, of course, was symbolically speaking of his suffering and his crucifixion. That's the term that he used during his prayers and agony in the garden before they arrived. But, okay, I find it interesting that the idea of cup in the Old Testament is often associated with judgment upon sin. Jesus was going to the cross because of God's wrath against sin. Not his own, but the sins of the world. Jesus drank this cup for us. It was God's will, and he had made his decision. Peter should not try to thwart him drinking it. Well, Luke 22:51 says, "But Jesus answered and said, 'Stop, no more of this.' And he touched his ear and healed him." The last miracle Jesus performed before the crucifixion. So, what did Malchus do after that happened? Well, in the movie, The Passion of the Christ, they had him just kneeling there, dumbfounded for quite some time. And, you know, they kept calling, "Malchus, Malchus!" I suspect that's probably so. And we got more of what Jesus said in Matthew 26. "Put your sword back into its place, for all those who take up the sword shall perish by the sword. Or do you think that I cannot appeal to my Father, and he will at once put at my disposal more than 12 legions of angels? How then shall the scriptures be fulfilled that it must happen this way?" See, this is one of those passages that shows us that we are not a militant group. As Jesus would later tell Pilate in chapter 19, my kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, then my servants would be fighting that I might not be delivered up to the Jews. But as it is, my kingdom is not of this realm. But Peter didn't understand that. Not yet. As you know, the popular understanding of the Messiah was that he was going to be a political and military hero who would lead them to throw off the shackles of the Romans and to restore them back to the glory days of King David. But that was incorrect. The only sword Jesus' followers are to use in this fight is the sword of the Spirit, which is the Word of God, Ephesians 6:17. The Crusades and the Inquisitions, they certainly come to mind. And yes, I know there was more to the Crusades than just religion, but even so. But here's the thing. Not only was Peter's act uncalled for, it was unnecessary. They could have no power over Jesus without his consent. As it's been said, Peter was like a mouse defending a lion. 12 legions of angels, that is 72,000 angels, 6,000 per legion. And I know the song says 10,000, but that's just because it rolls off the tongue better. 72,000 angels. So Jesus' rebuke and the fact that there was no real harm was done probably kept Peter from being arrested as well. There could have easily been four crosses up on Calvary. Well, Peter, I don't know, maybe he felt good because of his display here, his courage, but he'd find out later that he wasn't as great as he thought. There would be some very important lessons Peter needed to learn that night before he became the man that he would be in the book of Acts. And so, well, okay, they finally had Jesus in their clutches. And we see from Luke that he told them, this hour and the power of darkness are yours. Typically, you know, you're driving along and you see someone getting arrested, like my roommate and me. Well, usually you think the worst of them. You know, you would have looked at me and you'd have thought, shame, shame. But see, in this case, when Jesus was arrested, the worst was around him. And it's interesting to think about. The high priests had their plans. And the Pharisees had their plans. And Judas had his plans. And others who came had plans. But God used their plans to fulfill his plan. You see, later in Acts 2:23, Peter said that Jesus was delivered over by the predetermined plan and foreknowledge of God. Okay, the next scene is at the house of the high priest where two dramas took place. Because we got Jesus before Annas and then Caiaphas and Peter's denial interwoven throughout the passage. But that'll be for next week, and I hope you come back for that. Now, one thing that always amazes me, something that I would like to emulate more, is how Jesus was always so cool. Man, he was always so cool, calm, and collected. In these situations where, frankly, I would have probably just been all flustered or upset or thrown into a temper, something like that. The cup which the Father has given me, shall I not drink it? So what are some of the things we learn from our passage? All right, let me just give you three. Number one, Jesus can empathize with us when we go through betrayal. See, the next time a friend stabs you in the back, remember that Jesus knows exactly what that's like. Number two, the importance of listening to what Jesus has said. How often do we do like Peter? You know, instead of pulling out our sword, so to speak, and trying to deal with things in our own way, we need to listen to Jesus. And number three, that followers of Christ are not to be a militant group. This is not a word against the police or the military in the U.S. No, this is, see, it's Christ's kingdom is defended and spread by the sword of the Spirit. Now, as we can see from John 12 at Bethany, Judas was a thief, okay? His true love was money. And as it's been said, the Judases are not all dead. Like so many throughout the history of the world, Judas sold his soul for a bit of money. Yeah, well, you know, that would never happen to me. It happened to an apostle. And there are many, many different ways that we can betray the Lord today. So may we never follow in his footsteps. But if you're here this morning and you realize that you have betrayed Jesus in some way, and, well, you're ready to get back to him, you don't want to end up the way Judas ended up. You don't have to. I believe that Judas could have repented, and you can as well. If we can help you get back on that right track, please let us. This morning, if you're here and you'd like to talk to the elders, if you're here and you need to be baptized into Christ, if you're here and you'd like the special prayers of the congregation, please come forward now as we stand and sing.